I want safe passage through your space. Once my ship is beyond Borg territory, I'll give you our research.
Unacceptable. Our space is vast. Your passage would require too much time. We need the technology now.
If I give it to you now, you'll assimilate us.
Species 8472 must be stopped. Our survival is your survival. Give us the technology.
No.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, sitting on the edge of his couch for 3 months.
You really loved Unimatrix Zero, what can I say?
It had me enamored, and I needed to know how it resolved with the super boring Borg boyfriend.
And we're here this week to talk about the fine art of a season finale.
Yeah, Cam, we were meaning to tackle this a little bit earlier to just kind of help us figure out, you know, the Discovery season finale and what makes it work, but maybe what made it not work in some degrees, but we'll go
into
that.
Although we gushed about it pretty good in the podcast episode.
But we wanted to actually take some time to actually let it breathe for a little bit and come back to it. And then, lo and behold, we just got sidetracked a little bit. But I think this is interesting because, like, season finales are, of course, very different than series finales, but they have to do something within kind of the season as a whole for them to be successful. And why don't we talk a little bit about kind of the factors and the traits that go into a season finale that we think make them successful. For me, I think they should be tying up to a certain degree, you know, ongoing character and or story threads, but it also depends on what kind of series it is.
And what era.
Exactly. Because if it's a 1960s, very episodic where episodes are shown out of order all the time.
Yeah, salt vampires aren't showing up in that finale.
Exactly. So, yeah. But you know, if you get into more of the serialized era, look at Deep Space Nine, I think that's more in line with what they're doing. And Voyager actually did that to an interesting degree as well, because Voyager is often thought of as a more episodic series, but it's actually more serialized than I think a lot of people give it credit for as well.
Yeah. It's sort of more of an evolution of TNG. It doesn't feel like the next step post Deep Space Nine, but it's definitely doing kind of those episodic stories of TNG, but it does have overarching stories that do carry it forward.
Yeah. And so for me, it also maybe is a bit of a setup for what we can expect, you know, the following year as well. And so, look, I personally don't find the story-based stuff nearly as interesting as the character-based stuff. For me, it's really not, you know, kind of explosions hitting the console that makes it a great finale for me. It's what does this moment mean for the characters that we're following? What do their decisions mean for the future of their character arc and their growth? And if you can give characters conflict between one another, which is sometimes lacking in Star Trek... I think that just makes me that much more invested in what this means for the overall arc that we found ourselves at the end of the season.
Right, yeah. I really look to a finale, season finale, to be basically a catapult for the next season. Sure, the creators don't know what they're going to write for the premiere yet when they have put the finale out there, but I want to feel like the show has like serious momentum and is basically launching me to where I'm going next year.
Yes.
And you get that feeling from a lot of the really great ones in that the show feels like it is actually really on the creative fast track by the time you get to finale, which is really saying something and a real challenge to these writers, especially in the older days when they were doing like 26 episodes a season. Hey, can you make the last episode of the season really energetic and people should be excited to come back?
And we know your budget is blown for the year too.
Yeah, and they're just like, we don't want to come back at this point. We're tired. But a lot of the great ones do that where it wraps up and you're like, September can't come fast enough.
Yeah. So
although I say September, and that is not applicable to the Discovery era.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't even matter anymore at the age of streaming. But yeah. So, Cam, why don't we start with the original series? And just again, for the record, we're not tackling series finales. We're going to tackle that at a later time.
Yeah.
I think once we wrap up Enterprise at this point, or who knows, by the time we do that, maybe Discovery will be off the air by then, and we can full Discovery into that.
Yeah.
Too.
Although there's not a lot of Enterprise two-parters.
Yeah, so
we may get there quicker than we think.
Yeah, because the plan is moving forward. We're going to do the Voyager series finale for a review. Then we'll get into the Enterprise two-parters. And so maybe in less than a year's time, we can actually tackle the series finale question.
Yeah.
But let's start with TOS, Cam.
Yeah, so, you know, the season one ends with Operation Annihilate, which has the giant parasites that are flying around. And I guess if you're going to look at this as a finale, what makes it special? We do get the death of Kirk's brother, a character we've never met before, but that is pretty heavy.
And Sam is never mentioned again.
Only his sweet, sweet mustache.
Yeah.
Mentioned by us all the time.
I wish I could get a photo op with Shatner with a fake mustache
on,
so I could say it's Sam Kirk.
I never thought of that. That's incredible. But like, look, in the 1967, when this episode is being put together, they're not thinking, how do we go out with a bang? And I think you can say that pretty accurately, given that the episode before this is City on the Edge of Forever.
Sure.
Which I think should have been the season finale.
I agree there.
I like Operation Annihilate, but...
It's a perfectly fine episode.
Totally.
What's not a perfectly fine Star Trek episode, though, is Assignment Earth.
Yeah, from season two. Yeah.
This is essentially a backdoor pilot for a Gary 7 series, so... You wrap up the entire season mostly with Kirk and Spock watching Gary 7 on a TV monitor.
Which is what they were hoping audiences would do next year.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and I think that's accurate because I said, you know, you want to feel like you know where you're going next season to a certain degree. And at this point in time, Star Trek was dead in the water. Like, they did not think they were getting a season 3.
Yeah.
Gene Roddenberry's working kind of behind the scenes with fan groups to bombard CBS with letters, or was it NBC at that point, with letters to keep the show going, but they have no certainty of this. And so he really was actually kind of setting up his next season. It just happened to not be a Star Trek show. It happened to be a very confusing show involving a guy, a cat, and a confused secretary.
I'd love it if maybe in the Voyager era, they did a backdoor pilot for, I don't know, one of those UPN sitcoms that was on all the, Homeboys in Outer Space.
Right,
you know, that would have been great.
Shasta McNasty.
You know it. So
Assignment Earth is like such a weird one in that, like, we've talked about in oddball episodes. I'll post a link to that in the show notes, but it's really unsatisfying as a finale. And as if this had been in the finale of the original series, that would have been really grim.
Yeah.
And so I don't know.
All right. So let's jump over to TNG. The season one finale is the Neutral Zone, which is actually an okay finale, I think, for such a bumpy first season. There is some elements that don't work, like, you know, those 21st century cryogenically frozen people that come back and sing country music for some reason.
Where do I get a beer around here?
It was bizarre.
Like hammy, like broad comedy with broad comedy score on it.
Yeah, but you know what? You've got the Romulan element. They're setting things up for what's to come in season one. There's allusions to a very destructive force that's affecting both the Romulans and the Federation. I think what we're meant to believe later on is it's actually like the first hints of the Borg. And so it's interesting because we finally do get to meet the Borg the next season, and it all comes to a head, and maybe another season finale we'll be talking about quite soon.
I mean, when you have them saying like the Romulans are back, that's a pretty good finale.
Yeah,
like it actually does its job. The Neutral Zone is probably one of the better episodes of season one. It's got to be in the top three, probably.
I'd say so. What, that Data Lore and I don't know, maybe Encounter at Far Point, like just in terms of setting things up for the characters. I don't know.
I guess so. Yeah. I'm sure there's probably one we're forgetting, but yeah, like, I think the Neutral Zone's pretty good, and it does set up the Romulans, which, you know, is doing its job and saying, like, hey, this popular element of Star Trek canon you haven't seen since the original series, you're going to see them again in the next season. I can see why, especially if you look at it from the point of view of a viewer in 1987-88, being like, what the hell is this Star Trek show? I don't like this at all. And they end season one with the Romulans are coming back. You're like, well... I guess I am too.
Yeah. Let's jump forward to Shades of Grey, which I would rather watch Assignment Earth than Shades of Grey. Like, Shades of Grey
is... And I
is...
should know, I recorded a commentary for Shades of Grey.
Shades of Grey, I think, is, we could say definitively, the worst season finale ever produced in Star Trek. What's its competition? We'll get there, but Cam, it's.
I would say Assignment Earth is entirely unsatisfying if you're tuning in to see Kirk and Spock.
But you know, it's not a clip show. I think that's true. A clip show is so creatively devoid. You know, and look, they had the writer's strike that they were dealing with. I understand it, but this is just.
Why did they not swap it with Peak Performance?
It could have been production issues.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Because Peak Performance, like, is a good episode. Yeah. That's a way better way to end season two than Shades of Grey.
But this just doesn't. I think they're trying to make things all come together like you would in a season finale. You know, but it's just so odd that all of Riker's greatest, most significant memories all happen to take place in the last 18 months of his life.
And it's only in like 7 episodes or something. Yeah. Like they keep going to the same episodes.
So look,
it's weird.
Season 2 also, I think there are some improvements being made at this point. The characters felt more like their own. Riker grew the beard, you know.
Sure.
So.
But we said, you know, the Neutral Zone is among the best episodes of season 1. The Shades of Grey clip show is the worst episode of season 2, probably. There might be one in there that's really grim to sit through, but it's up there.
Yeah.
At least in terms of laziness, it's the worst.
But you know what? I think they leapfrog quite a bit there with the Best of Both Worlds Part 1.
Worst to best, really.
You got it there. Yeah. And look at what it's doing, though. It is. We've had all the Borg talk for quite some time, and you also have a Riker story here. And I think this is what I really like about these sorts of finales, where you have so much tension tied to what the character-based journey is for Riker and his decision about whether to leave the Enterprise or not. And he gets his chance to take command.
Yeah.
He makes the hard decision that he has to make by the end of it. And what it really sets up are what the implications are going to be for this decision we just saw him make when he says, Mr. Worf, fire.
Right.
And so I think this is really how you do a season finale in Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, Best of Both Worlds is one of the greats of all time.
One of the best.
Yeah. And, you know, what do you think it says about season 4? Because as sort of a launch point into season 4, does it feel like it's making a statement about what to expect going forward? We know we're going to see this episode, the story wrapped up at the premiere.
Well, this is the Pillar Era, and I think if people had not known it at that time, we're officially in, like, a great storytelling era for TNG. So yes. I think if you watch something like this, people are actually talking to each other and say, you know what, this TNG show isn't so bad. Maybe it's come into its own and we can expect only more of that going forward in season 4. As for particular storylines, I don't think anybody at the time could have anticipated you'd get an episode like, say, Family, where you actually have, you know, Picard dealing with repercussions of what happened to him as a drone. I think
you would not see that on, like, Magnum PI,
no.
Like a story that had a following episode where it was just him talking about what he'd gone through.
I know. It was such a weird turn for Magnum to get, you know, assimilated, too. Like, I was not expecting cyborgs to appear in Hawaii.
They wanted mustaches like him.
It's like the Sam Kirk whole deal. So, you know, there you go.
I like to think, though, with Best of Both Worlds, like what it really promised was confidence and a focus on character-specific stories. Because Best of Both Worlds, most people hold that up and be like, greatest Borg story ever. Whereas I look at it, and the Borg stuff is awesome, make no mistake, it is maybe the best Riker story.
I think it is.
Yeah, like it is such a fascinating, exciting, and dramatically interesting and involving Riker story. And we didn't see that sort of thing in season 1 or 2.
No.
You would see some sort of alien gimmick or a planet that had some sort of bizarre society. You would see Riker come down, basically kind of stand there awkwardly judging the planet or how do we fix this problem? Let's get out of here. That's not telling us anything about Riker, who he is with his internal life or anything. This is what season 3 is doing, and Best of Both Worlds is really going out with a bang by showcasing what we never knew we wanted with the character of Riker.
And it takes cojones for the writers to give Frakes 2 finales in a row after that first one, Shades of Grey.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? Yeah.
So let's hop over to another character-based one, Redemption. And this is, again, a culmination of what we had been seeing with kind of the buildup within the Klingon Empire. A lot of politicking had been going on. A lot of tension had been developed here. It can't be as explosive as, say, Best of Both Worlds. That is a premiere episode.
Yeah.
And I think they realized by then, like, Worf was really coming into his own as an iconic, multidimensional character. Certainly not the dimensions that we see of him on Deep Space Nine, but I think they really do appreciate that this is a guy who can have a showcase episode that
yeah.
has a bit of an epic feel to it. You hear Klingon Civil War, and I think that actually does excite people. It's not one of your favorites, though, but I definitely think that Redemption has its following. How do you think it stacks up, though, as a season finale in the way that we judge them to be good or bad?
Well, to me, it is very much of a piece with Best of Both Worlds. It's a similar tact. They're taking a very, like, dense Star Trek mythology story, you know, the Borg in Best of Both Worlds, the Klingons in Redemption, and they're focusing in on a character and delving into what that character's journey is through this two-parter, and for here, it's Worf. Kind of fascinating they didn't go a Data route, because I would have thought maybe at that point they would have gone Data.
Well, okay, you and I, we were having dinner the other night, and you and I got in a big debate about who's more iconic in pop culture. Is it Worf or is it Data? And I was saying, like, I think Data's a more important Star Trek character, but I think Worf might have it in terms of pop culture. I think people just might recognize him. But you made a very good argument for Data being that one.
Yeah,
and so that's kind of one of the reasons I'm leaning towards maybe Worf. He got a season finale, and
he's not in Picard.
That's true. Well, Michael,
he didn't have a whole crowd at Hall H cheering him on.
I cannot disagree with that. So yeah.
We'll let the listener at home listening to decide.
Okay,
I always see the listeners are at home. That's, I don't know why I always say that.
I listen to the vast majority of podcasts outside of my home.
So do I. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, well,
just a habit. I'm like old timey radio here, but but yeah, like
yeah, I think Tom Paris owns the same one.
Redemption, when he's not watching cartoons. But yeah, like Redemption does something interesting too, in that we see Worf in a very complicated place at the end. We don't know where he's going to go. We assume he's coming back to the Enterprise. But kind of like Riker saying fire on Picard, we can assume Picard's not going to die, but we still want to know, in the case of Redemption, why is Worf coming back?
Yeah.
Like, what is his experiences with the Klingon story going to be? And so, I think Redemption works in terms of being a season finale. Totally.
One of the things that we haven't touched upon is maybe the cliffhanger idea, though, because we see that for the first time in Best of Both Worlds, and they follow that up with Redemption. And one of the things is we maybe go deeper into it.
I did a cliffhanger episode that I'll post a link to for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And as I said earlier, like, you're waiting on your couch for 3-4 months until you get this resolve. And I like how a lot of the cliffhanger stuff that we're seeing here is very much character-centric more than story-centric.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, maybe I don't want to pick on Voyager too much, but sometimes the cliffhangers or more about the story beat that would come next versus the fallout from a big decision a character had to make.
Yeah.
So, let's jump ahead to Time's Arrow, which I think is a jolly fun jaunt.
I think right there you just said it. They're just at this point like, we're just having fun.
Yeah, like as far as a season finale goes,
yeah.
I don't know about this one.
What is like, now I'm blanking. What is the cliffhanger moment at the end?
It's the crew decides to go back in time to San Francisco.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's like, it's not the greatest cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But you know, I say that, and just seconds ago I said, you know, good cliffhangers are about being interested in the fallout from a big decision characters had to make. And the big decision is, do we go back in time to save Data?
I just wonder how much of the appeal and the decision-making behind this being your finale is that Star Trek has a really rich history with time travel stories. A lot of the greatest episodes of all time are time travel stories. And so when they're saying, we're going back in time, fans who know their Star Trek are thinking City on the Edge of Forever or Star Trek IV. They're like, this is going to be a story worth following, because how could a time travel and Star Trek story ever go wrong?
Do you think people are on the edge of their seats, you know, for those many months? I mean, you had the Data head thing. I'm sure people wanted to know how that was resolved. I don't know if many people thought it was going to be resolved by Data wearing a 500-year-old head for the rest of the series.
No, but, yeah, for sure.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not like the slam bang Best of Both Worlds cliffhanger. But at this point, we're in like, we're way into the seasons. They have their audience firmly in the palm of their hand. They want to see Star Trek come back no matter.
Yeah.
No matter what the finale. I think it's a way of acknowledging this show can be fun and come back and have fun with us.
Let me ask you this. Whose episode is this, though?
Well, the central, issue is Data going to be okay? So I guess you could argue it's about Data. It's about saving Data.
I'd just say this is more of a story-based episode than a character-based one. So that's kind of... Look, I think it's a fun episode, but I just don't know if it's one of the great finales that we've had in Star Trek.
But I would say the audience is more invested in seeing Data okay than the whales.
Yeah.
you know, as a tease. Like, had this ended with, like, we've got to go get whales, you'd be like, what?
Sure.
I guess you'd really be the, like, I can't wait to see how this wraps up, because I did not see that coming.
And we're talking about Prince of Wales.
Of course.
Yeah. So let's jump ahead to a character-based data story here, which is Descents. And
yeah,
we also kind of tie in the Borg mythos, dealing with both Hugh as well as Locutus and all the decisions.
And lore.
And lore. So it's a lot of decisions that have been building up, not just, you know, through the previous season, but through the previous seasons.
Yeah.
So I think they had a lot of the makings of, like, a very epic finale. I think... But there's just something about this one, like, it doesn't quite work all the way through for us, you know? It's,
yeah. Descent's a weird one in that when we reviewed it, even when I watched it the first time, I had mostly positive thoughts. Like, yeah. I enjoyed it. But it's one that does not stick in my mind, like, almost at all.
How much esteem do Star Trek fans have for this one?
You don't hear its name getting bandied about much.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, which is interesting, because, like, I think we actually like some of the smaller elements the most, with, like, Crusher commanding, like, a skeleton crew of people,
yeah,
that are kind of
right,
unqualified to be on the Enterprise.
Even the moment with Data losing control and, like, choking that Borg,
yeah,
is great stuff, and Brent Spiner's killing it, literally.
Yeah, it's frightening. So, I think, as I said, it has a lot of the makings of a great finale, and
yeah,
for whatever reason,
I mean,
it's a perfectly fine
It is
finale.
A fine one, and
yeah,
you have, you know, Lore walking out at the end,
yeah,
which...
Those abs.
I question, though, from the point of view of being a finale promising the next season, how much of the excitement is, oh my God, how is this going to affect Data and the rest of the crew by extension, versus, oh wow, what's Lore going to do? Which is very much the sort of thing that's going to be wrapped up in a single episode.
It doesn't, look, if you're going to do a Borg season finale.
Yeah.
I think you need to have something big in mind for the cliffhanger that could rival Best of Both Worlds. And
yeah,
Lore walking out to greet Picard just didn't quite do it for me.
Should they have done another Borg finale, given how, you know, Best of Both Worlds now is considered one of the all times, but I think even at the time was massive.
Yeah.
So
I think,
to go back to that, well,
I just think, you know, they'd stayed away from it for two seasons, so
yeah,
they figured, hey, let's give it one more shot. We're going into what's likely our last season, so why
yeah,
not?
Yeah, and I mean, does it feel to you like it works in with where they're going in season 7?
Sputtering towards the end?
I would argue it does,
yeah,
because a lot of season 7 is awkward goodbyes to characters.
That's true.
And we're bringing in Lore right off the bat,
yeah,
to set him up for his farewell from the series. Later on, we're going to see Ro, we're going to see Wesley, we're going to have some awkward goodbyes before an incredible finale of the series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cam, let's jump over to Deep Space Nine with In the Hands of the Prophets. And look, your mileage may vary with regards to the Bajoran politics stuff.
Yeah.
But this is a character-based episode. It's looking at a lot of the political tension that had been building up throughout the season. I think it works on paper. It's maybe not the most exciting one.
It's not big scale with,
yeah,
like the bombing of Keiko's school. That is not the Borg attacking. You know what I mean?
No,
like it's
no,
not. It's yeah, not big fireworks.
How much does the Neela stuff work for you? The technician that's on O'Brien's crew.
So well, Tyler, that when I was going back doing my notes for this episode, I'd completely forgotten about that whole subplot.
Okay,
and I had to Google a photo of her, and I was like, oh my God, yeah. Like, I really remembered the Keiko school stuff,
yeah,
as well as sort of the clashing between Vedic Barail and Kai Winn.
She wasn't Kai just yet.
Not yet, not
Vedic
yet.
Winn. I remember,
Vedic Winn,
like,
yeah,
the Vedic Winn stuff when I watched it first drawn. I was like, oh, I hate this character.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
That's the stuff I remembered, which is far more, I think, interesting than the Neela stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair
but
enough.
It is a good finale, but does it feel like a confident finale, like a show that knows where it's going?
I think the show is still finding itself.
Yeah.
At that point. And the thing is, they come back with the three-part Bajoran politics,
yeah,
kickoff to the season in season 2.
Yeah.
I think they thought there was far more interest in Bajoran politics amongst the fan base than maybe there really was.
Did they think there was more interest at that point, or did they not have the perspective to think beyond that?
I think, honestly, it was staring them right at the face. You have a wormhole next to you. I,
yeah,
think what would have made more sense if there was maybe more hints of the Dominion earlier on in the series. It took them about a year to get there.
I just remember how odd I thought that show was, not so much on the first time, but on the revisit, where they go to like other Gamma Quadrant planets, and they're the most boring planets ever, and
yeah,
you're like, really? Like, this is what...
Yeah.
This is the Gamma Quadrant?
Well, speaking of a planet that they went to in the Gamma Quadrant, we get the Jem'Hadar. Now, I think this is how you do a season finale, because there had been hints of the Dominion before that. And honestly, you're sitting down for a season finale, and it starts off with Jake and Ben and Nog on a camping trip.
Keiko's school, camping with Jake and Nog. You know, like, DS9 knew how to wrap up a season.
But Cam, at this point, you have the action really ramp up here. You have Jem'Hadar ships doing kamikaze maneuvers into a galaxy-class starship, which this is like the week that, you know, TNG goes off the air, too.
Yeah,
so it's I think they're kind of poking people a little bit. But this is really, look, it's a good way to kind of sew things up for what we saw the previous season and really planting the seeds for what's going to happen further down the road.
And you have the introduction of the Vorta, which is really interesting too. Like for me, it's an interesting finale in that I question how much people realized that it was really setting the stage for the season coming up.
I don't think they knew.
I don't think so either. And I would not be surprised if people were kind of meh on this finale at the time, not having the larger picture to go off of.
I think that it has only grown in people's viewing habits.
Well, it's so important now when you look back on it.
And so when you go watch, you know, DS9 for your third or fourth go, you're like, oh, I see what they're doing here. This is great. So,
because I imagine, like, when people are watching Redemption, for example, or even Descent, they're like, this is important.
Yeah.
Whereas I would be curious whether the Jem'Hadar had that effect.
I think maybe a lot of people thought they're kind of a one-off, but maybe not, though, because they were building the Dominion up throughout the season, and then the Dominion reveals itself, and then you're like, okay, so what does this mean going forward?
Yeah.
So I think there's still some intrigue there, but I just don't know if people knew the full implications of it at the time.
Or if people were that confident in the show yet, because even season two, DS9's a little rocky.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it is a really, really good episode.
Jumping forward to The Adversary, I think they ran out of budget here.
Really? Why do you say that, Tyler?
The entire episode takes place in the corridors of the Defiance.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much an homage to, like, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Sure.
With body snatchers thrown in as well.
Yeah. But does that make it a good season finale?
We referenced it in our panel, I think, how film influenced Star Trek. So they gave us that.
They gave us that, but as a season finale.
Yeah. In terms of a season finale, I guess my question to you is it tense enough? Because in terms of homages to that type of material, I always think of that X-Files episode, Ice, where they find, like, the worms that worm their way into people's heads and kind of steal their bodies. And that episode of X-Files is so, so tense.
But would that have made a good finale for the X-Files?
No, but I would say it is a classic episode. Whereas when I look at The Adversary, I go, it's good, but it's not a great episode. And so I'm kind of like,
I mean,
you're not putting your best foot forward in the end, even though I like The Adversary, even going off of similar hour-long drama sci-fi show episodes that are very similar in terms of theme and idea, it's not as good as that.
Yeah, it just didn't seem as epic as I think they'd been building things up to before that. At least we do get to see, you know, Sisko get a promotion. We're introduced to the engineering, the main engineering of the Defiant as well.
Yeah.
We do have, you know, Odo, big implications for Odo.
Yeah, the inciting incident for what's going to, you know, matter going forward.
In which he's the first changeling to harm another changeling. And I think that is very intriguing. So,
do you think they really had that in their mind when they were writing, having Odo kill the other changeling?
I think they did. Okay. I think it was, as you said, going to be the inciting incident moving forward for kind of Odo's journey has been tied so much to the mythology of Deep Space Nine, and I think that was very much a conscious effort on their part there. So I think that fell in with that.
Do you feel like The Adversary wrapped up season three?
I feel mixed.
You do have the search at the top.
I'll tell you my feeling when it aired.
Yeah.
I felt underwhelmed.
Right.
You know, I thought it was cool that Ben got a promotion, but I did feel underwhelmed at that point.
You know, when you have the search early on, which is such like a grand two-parter, you know, reconnecting Odo with his people, having the adversary at the end, they are bookmarking the season, but it feels very small compared to the first chapter.
Yeah.
So
They continue on with the Dominion mythology stuff. Not another Bajoran politics finale, but Broken Link. And look, it's a character-based drama with Odo tying back to Dominion mythology yet again. And look, the cliffhanger actually even ties back to the Klingon elements that were introduced at the very beginning of the season with the revelation that Gowron is a changeling.
So, well, they did tease in the adversary that they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And that really didn't pay off that much that season in an interesting way. So, like, this was kind of like the next stage of being like, you know, let's refine that statement a little bit and now say, hey, it's Gowron. That's actually implications we understand. We know who Gowron is. He's a character from TNG, so that really does mean something. So, like, I think it's effective.
It's effective, but it's kind of more on... I think this is a better episode than The Adversary, but it's still not these kind of epic episodes that I think we were seeing on, you know, TNG.
Well, do you really get, like, engrossed and exhilarated by an episode where Odo's sick for most of it?
No.
Yeah, you know. That's kind of the problem for me, is that I can say, hey, it's a good episode. It's continuing the mythology of the story. It's doing things for the Odo character. It all works on paper, and it's important to the overall picture of DS9, but as a finale launching me into the next season, it's not going out with a really kind of interesting finale. It's more that the last line about Gowron is what's interesting.
Even though we find out the next episode it's not true. But
yeah, what do you think that was all about?
Maybe it was just, you know, dramatic misdirect, or maybe they just revived their thinking. Maybe they just did not, like, I think what happened is, so they're like, oh, well, we need to end this with the destruction of the changeling. I'm talking about Apocalypse Now. We don't want to get
Apocalypse Rising.
Apocalypse Rising. We don't want to get rid of Robert O'Reilly from this series, so let's make it Martok, who is a character we've only seen once before, but I think they liked the character so much they kept bringing him back. Just the last thing to say about Broken Link, though, is, like, I do appreciate, though, that season four, for that direction that they take with the Klingons. So at least what we find out here, though, and this is really in retrospect, though, is, like, is the Dominion planting seeds to weaken the Alpha Quadrant. And I think that's a very important sort of element, but it wasn't clear to me at the time as a viewer.
And Broken Link also, of course, ends with Odo being kicked out of the Link and becoming a Solid, which is going to be hugely important to that character's journey.
For about 8 episodes.
Yeah, but it's a pretty great 8-episode arc.
I agree, yeah. So let's jump over to Call to Arms. Cam?
Nah, I don't remember this one at all.
Yeah, I know. This might be the greatest Star Trek season finale, period. It just it does everything that we've been talking about what makes a good season finale. It's a paying off all the buildup that we've had, you know, towards this point here. It's character-based. There's just so much tension. And the question is, we want to know what the fallout is going to be of all the decisions that the characters are making at this point.
Because they're all splintered by the end of this episode. We want to know how they're going to find their way back home to Deep Space Nine. Gul Dukat has taken it over. And you know that no matter what happens, you are going to have some sort of clash between our heroes and Gul Dukat. Something that has been teased right from the first season. Gul Dukat is beautifully built up over the course of these seasons as a villain that, you know, is just one of the all-time greats. And so you are waiting for that confrontation to happen in the next season. Like, it is a home run. And ending with that shot of Sisko on the Defiant is one of the all-time most brilliant closing shots of a Star Trek episode.
There's so many closing moments in this one, though. Yeah. Whether it's Dukat finding the baseball on the desk, it's Kira saying "Welcome to Deep Space Nine."
Yeah, or even Kira frying all the circuitry. You know, a couple scenes before that is incredible too. Yeah.
So this is really, like, we go into more depth on it in our evaluation of the Dominion War.
We also did an episode on this two-parter, the finale premiere. Yeah. So
take a look at that. And jumping ahead 1 year, Tears of the Prophets, I think it all makes sense on paper. You know, you have the Federation going more on the offensive. I think what sours it in a lot of people's mind, though, is the Jadzia death.
And right. And even just the Paw Wraith stuff by extension.
It didn't really seem like a good legacy for the character at that point. And also the cliffhanger, it was like... Sisko washing potatoes.
We go back and forth between clams and potatoes. Yeah, but it's one or the other.
it is not. I remember being underwhelmed by this one.
But is it a case of sort of the redemption? Look, I'm not going to forgive the Jadzia stuff. It's better done than the Tasha Yar death, but not by a massive margin. It's pretty weak. But I mean, was it ever going to deliver when you look at the previous season with Call to Arms? That it's kind of like your best of both worlds redemption, where, look, I will give Tears of the Prophets this. It is continuing to build up the tensions for where we're going the next season. But it feels more like a stopgap of just kind of like, well, we need to have some sort of cliffhanger. What could it be? When Sisko leaves, we know he's coming back. Season 7's not going to be like Sisko working in the family restaurant.
And look, I can disparage it a little bit, but it did have a good emotional moment where he takes baseball with him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's a good kind of parallel to what we saw just a year earlier.
Michael Dorn does some good work, too, with Jadzia's death.
He can roar.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's jump over to Voyager now. Cam, season 1 finale. I can't tell you how angry I was.
I rewatched this episode. We're talking about Learning Curve.
Learning Curve. So what happened for me, though, I'm watching it week to week at the time, and I watched Learning Curve, and like, okay, next week's preview is, you know, for a rerun.
Yeah.
And I kept watching reruns, and by then, it was like July. I'm like, when are they going to do the real season finale? That could not have been the season finale I watched with, like, Tuvok, like, training these crew members.
There's, like four Surly McKee.
Yeah. And, like, it was so bad. It was...
It's really dull. And then there's, like, the gas leak or something like that, where Tuvok has to, you know, save one of them. And you're like, okay, I don't think Tuvok's dying in a gas leak.
This is not how you do a season finale. But let me ask you this. The 37s, that was supposed to be the season one finale. How do you think that would have worked as...
I think that's a really, really fantastic finale because you have, you know, obviously...
Sorry, just for those who don't know, so 37s was supposed to be the season one finale, but instead it was held over and it was the season two premiere instead. But sorry,
right,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you have, you know, Janeway set up in the first episode, Caretaker, as the first female captain we've had on a Star Trek show before, or in terms of starring
as
in her own
lead,
show.
Yeah,
in the lead. And then to... end the season hypothetically with her meeting Amelia Earhart.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, that's genius. That is a absolutely fantastic way to wrap up season one by underscoring just how important Janeway is to the crew and to just the franchise going forward. Like, to me, that's, oh my God. As opposed to a story in which Neelix's cheese causes problems in the vents. Was it talk about gel packs half this episode through Learning Curve? I'm like, I can't believe I'm watching this.
Yeah. Let's jump over to basics. I
want to talk more about Learning Curve,
well,
Tyler.
That's the problem with you rewatching a horrible episode, is like you want to talk about it. No one wants to listen to it.
I know.
Basics. Okay. I think they kind of figured out Learning Curve was not a great finale. It was out of the producer's control. But
do you think they knew that it had really flopped? Like, do you think they cared, or do you think it was like, well, what can you do?
I think it's maybe what can you do? It was out of our control. But basics, I think they're fixing all those mistakes. So, and like they've been planting the seeds for the Kazon stuff. Not the best, you know, villains. But the thing is, the idea of like Janeway losing the ship, it would be repeated quite a bit through the series. But this is the first time that it happened. But I think it, very similar to the Deep Space Nine stuff, you see different characters put in different situations and you really wonder how this is going to be resolved, because they're on a cave planet. It's like they don't have some sort of technology or shuttle pod that they can jump into. So you're putting the hopes on, say, like the Doctor and Lon Suter and Tom Paris.
Yeah, to me, the reason this works so well is, you know, we know Janeway's getting her ship back. It would be pretty weird if Voyager from season two onwards was them like building, you know, huts on the cave planet. But although it would be pretty amazing, it would definitely go down in the books. But it's the fact of the wild card element of Lon Suter. We don't know where this character is going. We don't know what this could mean going forward. Maybe some people even thought he could be redeemed as a member of the crew in a few, you know, for season two. Who knows, right? Yeah. Like that question hangs in the air in this whole finale. And that's what to me is really interesting, in that it is, at this point, promising that they're going to do a certain amount of mythology ongoing in terms of its alien connections. I kind of admire them for going with the Kazon, because the Kazon weren't working. I think it would have been way easier to do a really fantastic two-parter with the Vidians, who I think were working a lot better.
Yeah.
But I give them a lot of points because I think they told a really great Kazon story in Basics. And, you know, That's definitely notable for an alien species that's not working. It's easy to pull out the Borg or the Klingons and be like, we can do a really good episode of them. Kazon? that's an uphill battle.
But, you know, I think they had painted themselves into that corner with just all the...
Seska stuff.
The Seska stuff, as well as the Mike Jonas stuff. And
I always forget about Mike Jonas.
I know. But they had to make it pay off. And look, it worked, and it could have gone badly.
Yeah.
And look, you follow up a year later with Scorpion. Again, this is what you're supposed to do with a finale, because they've been planting the seeds for a Borg confrontation for a while. And... Kim, you and I love the Janeway Chakotay back and forth in this, and this is really what we wish that we had saw more of throughout the course of the first three seasons. And look, I am down for a best of both world esque return to form for a Borg finale versus what we got in Descent.
What makes this finale to me extra impressive? TNG does the Borg, and it's fantastic, right? But season three of TNG, they've really got their S together. Like, everything's clicking. You know, there's a few bumpy episodes, especially in the early sections, but they really get the ball rolling, and they know the show they're making. Whereas, I was reminded, a friend of the show, Scott Hardy, was doing a rewatch of Voyager recently, was talking about, like, how season three was kind of weak, and I was like, was it? And I started scrolling through on IMDb, just the episodes, and I'm like, yeah, season three was really spotty.
Yeah.
And the fact that the finale was so strong with Scorpion shows that the writers, they could tell a story, but you could tell they were struggling throughout that season. It does feel kind of like the moment of clarity that I really do think does carry into season four.
And I think Voyager can easily be divided in two, in like the pre-Seven era and the post-Seven era. And so I think this is really, as you say, kind of... telegraphing what is to come moving forward in the series, where it's more of the high concept sort of stuff, less of the character-based stuff oftentimes, but I think this is great.
It's interesting, though, because we often argue for character-based stuff, right? But you do see in those first three seasons, they're doing a lot of character stuff with characters they're not that interested in.
Yeah.
So it's almost better they just went high concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jumping forward, we have Hope and Fear. And I remember at the time, I was like, oh, they don't want to do a big cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
I think this one, it's a little overlooked by fans. This is actually a really good finale in that it doesn't need to be an explosive cliffhanger for it to resonate in terms of it's collecting all the good character stuff that's been building up, especially as Seven of Nine grapples with A, you know, the concept of what is home, and then B, how culpable is she for being an assimilated Borg drone from age, you know, six onwards.
Sure.
Know?
And also the ramifications of Janeway making the deal with the Borg and how that has impacted others. So in a way, it's almost like the family, in a way, the episode Family, connected to Scorpion, you know what I mean? Like,
sure,
it's kind of like their version. It comes later as a finale, but it is about what that experience of the Scorpion two-parter has led to.
Yeah, you know, I never figured out why Tom and Neelix were rolling in mud in this one, and now it all makes sense with you.
That was just the actors, actually. That was between takes.
Yeah, yeah. Don't know how it made it on air. Yeah, this is a great one. I would definitely recommend people, just for those who don't know, it's the whole kind of idea is like, oh, the Federation sends back an advanced ship to collect them and bring them home, but maybe not all is as it seems.
Do you know why they went with just a single one-hour episode?
I think they just wanted
to try... Or as opposed to a cliffhanger, I should say.
I think they just wanted to try something different. I think Brandon Braga said, we don't need to do a cliffhanger every year. Like, why don't we try this out? And I think it works.
Because doesn't the next season open with Night?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting in that Janeway's really being called to task for her actions in this story. And then we cut to the next, you know, to the premiere, and she's very much in a state of doubt and melancholy.
Yeah.
So, like, I do think it's a really interesting pairing. And even if it's not a connected story, like, say, Scorpion, it's keeping the themes consistent and moving them forward into the next season. And I was actually kind of impressed with the way this one ends with its antagonist, Arturus. You know, here is a guy who's lost his people to the Borg, and we end with Voyager basically leaving him to get assimilated by the Borg. Like, that's really grim, heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And I kind of give them points for going there because it sticks with you. Like, that is an image that stuck with me after watching it.
That's why I would really push people to go back and rewatch that one for sure. Jumping ahead, Equinox. So I don't know so much about this being kind of a culmination of what had happened or transpired throughout the lead up during the season, but I think this is very much a culmination of the series, though, like up until that point. Like, the decisions that different Starfleet officers make depending on their circumstances come back to haunt them to a certain degree. And maybe the argument could be made is Janeway got lucky way more than, you know, the crew of the Equinox and Captain Ransom. And that's why...
Well, they had the Fairhaven program.
Exactly. Yeah. Janeway did get lucky.
Yeah.
Sorry. But so this to me is a really strong Voyager finale. Like, I think I might... I remember watching it at the time, and I wasn't a fan of the cliffhanger, where it's like one of those, you know...
it's really dumb.
It's one of the interdimensional aliens attacking Janeway.
Is it even attacking? It's like it's flying at the camera.
But the question is Janeway going to be all right when you come back see in the next season? And the answer is yes, she is. Yeah. So, and you kind of knew that. So it's not a great cliffhanger, but I think it's a great two-part episode.
Yeah.
You just kind of forget about that cliffhanger.
It's sort of like an alternate universe Voyager story, too, in that the show, as pitched originally, is... you know, this crew that's kind of squabbling and at odds with each other, trapped in the Delta Quadrant. Who knows what they're going to go through to get home? The show isn't really that. It quickly finds a different track it wants to follow. But the Equinox really does kind of say, like, for the fans, it's like, here's what the show could have been. And, you know, enjoy it for that.
Yeah. maybe you didn't enjoy so much. Unimatrix Zero.
Yeah, I mean, I was kinder to it, I think, on the revisit than I was in the initial viewing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I don't even know what to say about Unimatrix Zero.
They went back to the Borg well, and I just don't know if it was a compelling enough story for them to justify it. And it was interesting, because this is actually not originally going to be a Borg story. It's about, like, an entirely different alien species with, like, a collective consciousness sorts of dream sort of deal, you know, which is interesting. But I don't know if it's, like, two-part... you know, season finale, sort of interesting.
Yeah. Does this feel a little bit like Voyager's Descent?
Yeah.
Where you're going back to kind of repeating the classic, in this case, Scorpion. You're like, here's another Borg two-parter. And, you know, it's just not as inspired. I mean, it's weaker than Descent for sure. But, it continues the mythology, I guess. Does it do its job in paving the way for the final season?
In that, I guess we are going to have one last confrontation with the Borg in the series finale.
Yeah,
I guess. And just, I don't know.
Maybe putting Seven on kind of the last stretch of her journey within the context of the final season of Voyager. Maybe
you're being kind to it again. I think it's the weakest finale after Learning Curve. So,
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Let's jump over to Enterprise. Shockwave. I'm trying to make the Temporal War stuff pay off. I don't know. I was never really intrigued by the Temporal War stuff, and I don't think the writers were either, and I think it kind of shows. I think it's a great name for a finale, Shockwave.
Enterprise has some really good names for episodes, actually.
Yeah.
They're very, like, 2000s, you know, metal fingers in the air kind of titles.
E-squared.
Yeah. E-squared.
but this was the era that my patience was running thin with the series, and it took me another 10 years to go back and rewatch everything, but I'm glad I did. But
this one does a couple things that I think are kind of weak. One is the whole Enterprise being recalled back to Earth. Like, well, your mission's over, Archer. Yeah, sure.
After one season.
Yeah, I'm sure this show is really going to be, you know, Archer on Earth filling out paperwork. But then second of all, you have him getting stranded in the year 3000 with Daniels in, like, the decimated Earth. We know he's going to get out. And they're like, you'll never escape from this, or we're trapped here forever. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really tell me anything about the character of Archer either. It's like, okay.
To me, this is more story-based than anything else, and that's why
it's a story the writers weren't invested in.
Yeah. One that they were invested in, because I think it was meant to be as a bit of a reboot for Enterprise, was the Zindi. And this is how you do a season finale.
Oh, with the Expanse, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
The Zindi's the premiere.
The Zindi was a premiere, but the Expanse is how you do a season finale.
Because, it's a great one.
Yeah, because look, you are kind of, not so much like paying off the stuff that had been built up in season two, which is more of a slow-moving season, but this is really trying to set you up for what you're going to get moving forward and really excite you with regards to that. It was also, you know, they're just tapping on the shoulder of 9/11 at this point. And again, your mileage will vary depending on the interpretations that you get out of this. And we know that John Billingsley, who speaks at the conventions very candidly, he was not a fan of how jingoistic at least season three would be.
Right.
But I do like the fact that Star Trek is realizing, hey, we have the opportunity to tell these very contemporary stories within our, you know, futuristic framing. Why don't we do what's on everybody's mind? And I think this is an interesting snapshot of what was going on in the American psyche back in that era.
And that's what makes it interesting to me. It wasn't maybe jingoistic, probably, but so was the attitudes in the air at that point in time. I think that's honest. And, you know, I'm never going to fault something for being honest about the, you know, the real world events it's commenting on. I look at the episode from the original series, Private Little War, which is commenting on Vietnam. Is it naive in some ways? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But it was what they felt in 1967 or 68 or whatever it was when they were writing that episode. So, like, yeah, like, Shockwave, the emotion of Trip losing his sister and the attack on Earth, like, it is a gut punch when you see it. I think it's really effective.
Might be my favorite Enterprise finale, and it might be one of my top five, you know, Star Trek finales, period. So.
And it's great, the finale. I should say the ending of the finale episode with the Enterprise flying into the expanse.
All you can do is just wonder what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that is, you know, I commented on Lon Suter saying, like, that's a wild card because you don't know where it's going to go. You have no idea where the next season of Enterprise is going to go. And, like, it's just like, you cannot wait to see what the show is going to do. Because season two is, aside from the temporal Cold War stuff, really episodic. And it's, I think, the weakest season of Enterprise. And so to know that they're going on a mission, that is really interesting. And in some ways, you see this finale echoed in one we'll talk about in a little bit.
Okay. 0 Hour. Well, this is the culmination of everything that had been building up throughout the season. I feel a little mixed in that, like, I think it's a great slam bang sort of episode to cap off this whole Zindi arc.
Yeah.
But then can we have space Nazis at the end and you're just kind
of
your
really
face
deflated.
Goes into your hands
yeah.
and you're like, oh, what am I watching now?
Yeah, it's like Patterns of Force, only worse. Yeah, like all the stuff in terms of destroying the Zindi, you know, weaponry and all that, it's a sort of thing that for Star Trek should feel maybe clunky and not great, especially given production values at that time. It is very Star Wars-y. But it really works. And yeah. I think a lot of that has to do with Bakula. Bakula is on fire in 0 Hour and he's outrunning fire. Like, yeah. It's incredible stuff.
Rima, I just like the Shran elements where it's, you know, you're seeing kind of the seeds being planted for these, you know, centuries long alliances that will continue on between the Andorians and the humans and the Vulcans. And I really like how this seems to be a culmination of all that.
Plus, you have season three is such a journey, an often exhausting journey, just because of how intense the Zindi threat is, as well as all the real world implications we're bringing to it with obviously the 9/11 connections. Like, it's a heavy season. And it really does build to like a big cathartic, like, wow kind of moment, which is why I hate the space Nazi stuff, because it really does suck the air out of the room.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is, I think, a really great finale. Although, I would be curious to know, I mean, I guess I can say for myself, like, when this ended and it's like space Nazis, like, as a platform for season four, in a way, it's promising something inconsequential. It's like, yeah, we're going to something goofy. Because no matter what it is, you know that this is not the status quo of season four.
Yeah, it's not going to take place in alt reality, a man in a high castle sort of universe.
No, yeah. It's like we have just gone on this 22 episode journey through the expanse. Characters have changed so much over the course of these episodes. The story of Enterprise has really deepened. But now we're going to space Nazis.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh. Okay.
So I feel almost the opposite way about Will You Take My Hand in Star Trek Discovery here, in that, like, I think 0 Hour was a great example of everything paying off within the body of it and then having a weak cliffhanger. And I think Will You Take My Hand is a great example of nothing really paying off in a satisfactory way in the body of it, but having an amazing cliffhanger that made me actually excited for what was
and
to
that
come.
Cliffhanger is only like 1 minute or something.
If that.
So it is kind of, I mean, we're basically saying it's a weak episode.
It's pretty bad. You had all this build up to the Klingon War, and it was one that we never actually felt as if there was much tension going on in this Klingon War, save for, I guess, the preceding episode after they got back from the Mirror Universe. But just with this, it just seems as if Deus Ex Machina comes to the rescue, you know, the war is resolved because All of a sudden, Laurel has access to hydro bombs in the Klingon, like, volcano network. It was just like,
it's
what?
Interesting that that never came back into play in season two. Like, Laurel was never making comments about her bombs in the planet.
But this is all just story-based stuff. Yeah. And it's not like the Klingon War was resolved because of character decisions, or it's more just Burnham speechifying and I don't know.
And just the deus ex machina of Georgiou.
Yeah.
This character they bring over from the Mirror Universe to solve everything, which is really weak. And, I mean, it all wraps up with what you kind of want, which is the crew assembling, the recognition that they are a family now and are going to be going on adventures together. But it also ends with one of the all-time terrible Star Trek speeches, which, you know, if you...
We are Starfleet.
Yes. Yeah. Like, for a bumpy season...
What does that even mean, Cam?
I don't know.
We have principles.
Yeah. We believe in what we believe in. Yeah. It's a sort of thing that for a bumpy
season... It was not a Picard speech.
You can salvage a bumpy season. Like, Discovery season one I really enjoy, but it is very bumpy. But you can tie it all together in a speech that at least is kind of giving you the promise and optimism for the next season as to why the characters matter to us and why their ongoing journeys matter to us. And this speech is just like... It's like the speaker didn't even bring notes and didn't even know they were giving a speech.
No.
It's really lousy.
Yeah, but the finale with the cliffhanger, though, just seeing... It wasn't just the sight of the 1701. It was the music humming. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, I'm sold. I am...
it's amazing. Yeah. But it's also like falling back on, okay, nothing original of our own creation worked, so let's bring in the classic music and the Enterprise.
Oh, Cam, you know me. You know sort of stuff I hate.
Yeah.
But it just worked for me.
Oh,
that
it worked
moment.
For me too. Yeah. Believe me. At the time, I was like as excited for that as I was for seeing Jerry Ryan in the Picard trailer.
Yeah,
like,
no
I
kidding.
Was just jaw dropped. And then I think, doesn't it even wrap up with the credits with the original series theme?
It might, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, for me, that's a that's a home run ending.
I would say that they do improve things with Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, a very action-heavy episode. I think literally the most action-heavy episode of Star Trek of all time. I think that includes movies as well.
Yeah.
Just nonstop action throughout this?
The Kelvinverse, maybe 2009 is pretty explosive, although the sustained length.
That's
of,
what I'm getting at, though. And just think about, like, screen time of action in this. It's, like, pretty much, like, 65 minutes. And, the Kelvinverse might have 50.
It often feels a little bit like what Marvel's doing now with its movies like Endgame or Infinity War, where... You see at the big battle here in this season two finale, every character from the season is like showing up.
Yeah.
It's really like paying off everyone. You know, Poe is showing up. Saru's sister's flying in. It's like, wow.
Laurel.
Every single character is coming together. They've all been CG'd together into this grand canvas like the Marvel Universe. And you know what? It's the type of thing that really works.
Yeah.
Like, Marvel succeeds because it works. Discovery's finale succeeds because it works.
There's some weaker elements. I just think that Leland was a complete dud of an antagonist. Yeah. And having to watch him and Georgiou fight, I mean, I can appreciate it on a technical level, but I was not emotionally invested whatsoever in this. I also think that the dispatching of Admiral Cornwall was a little abrupt, and it didn't really have that emotional gut punch that I would have thought from, like, a character that I liked a lot.
I mean, they obviously wanted to have a major character die because that's the sort of thing you do in a finale that really does sucker punch people and have that sort of emotional big, you know, moment. Problem with it is I like where they're going and that it's a sacrifice moment. She's doing it for, you know, her fellow Starfleet officers. It's just that, believe me, there's plenty of nitpicking out there about this moment already. I'm not adding anything new to the conversation, but it's just like...
You rarely do.
No, that's true. And yet I just keep going. But there's a lot of ways that, you know, even fans are coming up with, like, this situation could have been resolved a different way.
Yeah.
Like, this really does feel kind of cheap.
Yeah.
And I will say, mostly due to the actress and also Anson Mount opposite her, it really does work for me emotionally in the moment, but it is the sort of story element that you go, was it necessary?
No. Yeah. No, it wasn't.
It really only was in the sense of, like, we want this character to have a end point because we know she's not going forward.
Yeah. So what it does do, though, is it sets up the series moving forward. Like, I finally know what I can tell people what Discovery is about. It's about a ship lost in time.
At least for one season.
At least. Well, I don't know.
We'll
see. No, I think it's, you know, why?
I just
why
don't
do you think
know.
That's a question mark, though?
Because I would not be surprised if they decide to shake up things up severely every season. That wouldn't surprise me just from the way they've been going.
What would the remainder of the...
I have no idea because I didn't know we were going here in the first place.
No, but there's... I've mentioned it before, but you know the speech that you have, you know, Pike and Spock and Number One giving?
Yeah.
So there's really... And just based on everything we know about kind of the Star Trek mythos, there's no reason to ever think that Discovery will be going back to that time period.
I agree.
So that's why I say you can say that this show is about a ship lost in time at this point.
What if they find something, though, and they're no longer lost?
I'm not exactly sure what that even means, but anyway.
Season 4.
Yeah, so I as I was saying, we now know what the series is about, though. It is about a ship lost in time, and I think this has me much more excited about the future of the series than I was, especially after Will You Take My Hand, which was, you know, pretty embarrassing.
Although we were excited because of the Enterprise.
That's
true. But the rest of it, yeah. This is the one I was saying, similar to The Expanse. We have the ship flying in one of the greatest sequences of, like, Star Trek I've ever seen. Oh, my God. When they are flying and taking off into the, you know, following Burnham, it's incredible. And I just feel the same way I did at The Expanse, where, like, anything could happen. And I want to see what that journey is going to be. And I'm just counting the days for Discovery to come back. So, like, it did its job.
Yeah.
It really did. And so, you know, when we look at, like, what the art of the finale is, this, you know, this Discovery second part, like, it has some quibbles you can have with it, but I think it did its job really well.
Yep.
Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, Cam, we are actually in Las Vegas right now for the big Star Trek Las Vegas convention. So we will be doing a recap of it about our highlights of this entire trip. We'll have some special guests on the show, too. And it's just going to be a fun wham-bang sort of recap of everything that's gone down. And an exhausting week for us, but one that we enjoy immensely every single year.
For sure. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vedic Win Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-A-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Neutral Zone Bumpkin.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.